it's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 19th of June. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by Island, the stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. You'll find them in Ocean View Road, Onirua. On the 19th of June, Sharon Brown talked to Janine Clarkin from Waiheke Community Art Gallery, Community Board candidate Ewan Sutherland, Andrew and Millie Watkins, who are running a course on personal economic sustainability, and Fiona Gregory from Waiheke Community Education Centre.
Okay, well, I've managed to track down Janine, and she was actually enjoying the exhibition. So there are lots of people up there this morning. This is at the Artworks Community Gallery. There's quite a buzz. Lots of artists up there still setting up little bits and pieces or checking on their work after last night. And, just lots of people coming through. Hi, Janine. How are you doing?
Kia ora. Good morning, Sharon. Kia ora. Good morning, everybody.
So tell us, what's all this? Have you got some stuff in the exhibition?
Yes, I curated the exhibition, which just really means found all my friends to put works in. So I have two pieces in myself. So the theme for the show is Matariki me ona tamariki, which is Matariki and her children. And within the show we've got two blended themes. So my theme, a woman's work is never done, honouring traditions and continuity for Māori women, so honouring manaakitanga, whanaungatanga, and just...
Can you just explain what those are?
Manaakitanga is like just how women are like always hosting and caring for, looking after their families and everybody. So we've got works that relate to cooking and doing the dishes and hanging up the washing. and some dedications to their children and the tireless efforts that they put into those. And so that's supported by the United Schools show, which is the Puna Reo, Waiheke Primary, Te Hurihi Primary, the bilingual unit within the Te Hurihi Primary, the Waiheke High School and the Steiner Home School all have works presented in there.
Wow, that's quite incredible that you managed to get all those people together to contribute things. Yeah.
Yeah.
And are those works for sale? Or?
Yes, all the works are sales, and we've got a few red dots up there already. Some of the children's works have been brought up, and also some of the adult work. The adult work are like, we have Poi from Ngahina Hohaya, who's renowned for her poi mahi and made out of blankets and embroidered with symbols from parihaka and just pertaining to domesticality and manaakitanga and whanaungatanga as well.
Right, so it's quite an interesting idea to celebrate the work of women, because as you may or may not know, that I suppose you do know, often women artists don't get any kind of recognition or struggle for recognition. I know I was talking to a woman who's a French artist, and she said something like 96% of French galleries exhibit work by men and not by women.
And also just the type of work with the textiles and the fashion. So to some, like... No doubt in France, they're not regarded as art, they're regarded as craft. So just to where it's now become kind of a growing trend to have textile artists in the high-end art world, so that's pretty awesome.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's almost like fashion is then having an influence on craft, and then craft is becoming art.
Yeah, with like in the last 20 years, artists like Annie O'Neill with her crocheted circles and all of her knitting, and Judy Darrow with her textile work, and Jacqueline Fraser. So that just leads the way into more people, like with Ngahina and her poi, Paula Coldheart with her blanket, which have kind of become heirlooms, and myself with my blanket work, and also Suzanne Tamaki.
So are these people that you're mentioning, do they tend to be Māori? because I'm just wondering if there's maybe also a drive in New Zealand because there's the indigenous culture and a lot of that is craft oriented, and whether that's also influencing the art.
The majority of the show are, however, there is some, well, there's certain things that we go for, like the blankets, there's a lot of Māori, but we have a bit of felt work in the show, which is a local girl here, and there's a lot of tapestry, which is by Sylvia Weber, who's French, and there's Paula Coldheart, who's done tapestry as well. So then there's weaving by Māori, and then the blanket work, and there's sort of different cultures are kind of attracted to different craft.
Mm. Oh, okay, interesting. So are these expensive items, or is there a range of things that are cheaper and more expensive?
We have like the tapestries, which are quite sizable. They're like priced at around between $3,000 and $13,000. Then we have some muka taonga weave, which is really high end weaving, and they're $2,000. So then we have the poi, which are about $200 and something. So yeah, they vary.
And then the children's artwork is also for sale.
The children's artwork's for sale. And we've been having this, I had this little discussion with my boys to like, who might buy his work? And I was like, well, if you want it, you better buy it yourself.
Oh, okay.
And then we kind of never occurred that a complete not stranger, but someone else altogether would buy it. And so it's been brought by someone else and going off to London.
Oh, okay. Is this the son that we've got standing here with the headphones on?
Yeah, that's Noor.
Right. So, Noor, can I ask you a question as well? Okay, so go and stand next to the microphone. There we go. So what did you make for the festival?
I made a painting of Matariki.
Lovely. And who bought your painting?
My auntie wanted to, but she was too late.
Ah, okay. Oh my goodness, fighting over your Matariki painting. How does that feel? Was that exciting?
Yes.
Lovely. And so who bought your painting in the end?
Elizabeth Corey Pierce bought it.
And do you know her?
Yes.
Right. Oh, okay. Well, that sounds fabulous. Well done. Were you sad not to buy it yourself?
Not really.
Okay, excellent. Well, I guess that's one aspect of art, isn't it? That it goes out to other people who can also appreciate it and enjoy it. Thanks so much, Noor. Okay, well, lovely. Maybe I could just get from you what's left of the exhibition. How long is it running for?
The exhibition runs till July the 14th. This morning at 11 a.m. I'm doing an artist talk, so I'm just going to run through some of the pieces and their meanings behind them. Some of them are like obvious, but the artists have written some of their personal thoughts on what's inspired them to make those pieces.
Lovely. Oh, that sounds like a fabulous event. Yeah. Okay, well, I wish I could be there, but I will be down here. But thank you so much for coming in. It sounds like a really interesting exhibition, and I'll go and have a look after.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. So that was Janine, who's curated the show up at the Community Art Gallery, Matariki, with a women's focus, lots of tapestries, blankets, Māori arts, and also the children from the schools have been involved, all the schools and the homeschool groups and the Steiner School and I think some of the kindergartens. So, yes, get down to that festival. Not festival, why do I keep saying that? To the Community Art Gallery. Well, I've got Ewan in with me now. Ewan Sutherland. You may know him from the gardening column in the Gulf News. Hi, Ewan.
Hi, how are you?
And He's going to be standing for the community board, so he's just come in to talk about that, probably the first of many people who'll come in and chat. And if there's anyone standing who would like to come in and chat, just get hold of Waiheke Radio and we'll find a little slot for you to come and talk. So Ewan, what's all that about? How did you get into standing for the community board? That's quite a big step.
Well, it was initially my partner Hans who suggested I get a desk job, basically. But because I currently work in a vineyard, and that's a physical workout for me, which isn't bad, but it doesn't engage my brain too much. So, and I started to think about it and think, well, yeah, I've been here 14, 15 years, and why not give it a shot? And I believe I want to stay here for the rest of my days, so if I can make a difference, that would be good.
Okay, lovely. And so what kinds of challenges do you see as...
Well,
being part of that role?
At the moment, of course, no one really knows exactly what the community board's going to be responsible for, because the transition agency hasn't come down with a budget or pay or salaries or anything like that. So we can only talk really in broad terms at this stage. But I am very interested in the UNESCO Biosphere Reserve idea. And on that point, there is a public meeting on the Sunday, the 27th of June at 2 p.m. to discuss the whole idea of setting up a reserve on Waiheke and what it means for the community board and their involvement for the elections. And this is going to be a public forum at the Ostend Hall, so anyone who's interested, do come along, because the more people who are involved and bringing their opinions forward, the better.
Okay, and so there have been quite a few public meetings around the Biosphere Reserve. So where are we up to now? What are the, you know, can you give us a little summary of what's been established so far?
Basically, it's just been about describing what a biosphere is, and there are hundreds around the world, none in New Zealand, only a couple in Australia, and how they work to provide a development in a sustainable way for a community without, as it were, destroying the goose that lays the golden egg. So what is it about Waiheke that draws people here? What is the, you know, main economic driver for Waiheke, and how do we preserve that? Because obviously, you know, it's the 21st century, development's going to happen, but it needs to happen in a way that isn't going to destroy the very nature of what Waiheke is.
Mm. Now, it might be difficult for you to comment, but what's the sort of point of contact between Auckland City and local governance and a biosphere reserve? You know, how do those two things interact? Because obviously you've got the policies and procedures of a city council, and then you've got a biosphere which is focused on sustainability in the community. And, you know, how can those influence each other?
Well, it has to be legislated by national government to start with, and then it goes from there, and each biosphere is different in terms of its needs and development criteria. So we're just at the beginning stages of this in terms of looking at what it would mean for Waiheke and the community board and local governance here.
Mm. Okay, and do you know what legislating would mean? I mean, what would, you know... I mean, aside from us saying, oh, we're a biosphere, what would change?
It would just lay down a foundation for development and, you know, local issues, as I said, so that the area maintains its distinctiveness, which is essentially why people come here, is because it's not the same as, you know, Auckland. It is different. And I feel strongly that we need to maintain that so that we have an economic an edge on the rest of Auckland to encourage people to still come here, you know, and it involves everything from transport to roading to septic waste to water, and I think energy conservation, down to even the weed problem on the island, which I think is a huge issue.
Mm. So is it a sort of, it's a perspective in a way?
Yes, it's an overriding sort of thing,
right.
Umbrella to
okay.
for which to plan.
Right. Okay. No, it sounds really interesting. So what, obviously you're standing for the community board. So have you got specific things you would like to see or specific interests that you have as a someone who'd be on the community board?
As I just mentioned, I work in a vineyard, and also the weed issue on the island is a problem, and how we tackle that. I know in my very own garden I used a product called Vigilant, which you put on the stumps of plants, and it just even the fumes from that, not actual contact, was enough to destroy plants. So and even in the vineyard where it was used underneath old established vines, in their complete dormancy, killed the vines. So we have a policy now of digging out gorse and other such weeds. But on farmland, they're using sprays which may affect vineyards. So there's a and you know, the wine industry is another important string in Waiheke's bow, and that needs to be looked after as well. So there are two almost conflicting issues there that needs to be sorted through.
Oh, that's interesting, because I understood that some people are unhappy with the way the vineyards are spraying vines.
Well, that's true, but as most vineyards are going towards sustainability as well, that looks at using organic sprays and the like anyway. You know, we're basically, I think, really heading in the right and in the same direction, hopefully.
So has there been a lot of interest on the island in organic sprays and organically grown wines and or minimizing the use of sprays?
Yeah, I think there is. And there are a number of community gardens already on the island, and this is another aspect I'm keen on, of course. People growing their own food and becoming resilient. That brings in the civil defence. You know, they want us to be resilient, to be able to survive on our own for 3 days. So we already have access to our own water supplies. We already get rid of our own septic waste, except for what gets carted away to the mainland. So, you know, the mentality is here to hopefully, you know, go down that road.
Mm. Well, it's really interesting, of course, being a land, you know, an island, things are a little bit more difficult. And I was talking to Jane at civil, someone in civil defence in Wellington who manages the whole mm-hmm. get-through strategy. And she was saying, you know, you might find that as an island, you need to be looking at some of the policies we've got for the Chatham Islands, because they're also an island. So, in fact, there are variations on that. So we say there that people should be able to sustain themselves for a week rather than the 3 days.
Well,
so I thought that was quite an interesting point that she made, you know, that it might be tricky if everything's down in Auckland for, you know, the food suppliers to actually make it that extra distance.
Absolutely. And the idea of things, you know, like infrastructure, like bringing water from the Waikato over to Waiheke, that just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm.
And that just is running down the road of mad development. I don't think we should do that.
Mm.
We have the opportunity to really be more self-sufficient than we are in terms of local energy production.
Mm.
I mean, about 2 years ago there was a storm and we had intermittent electricity supply for 3 days because the power went down in Whitford, wasn't it? And so the supply was disrupted. We can't necessarily rely on stuff from the mainland.
Mm.
And the more people have their own gardens, their own energy production, whether it just be solar hot water heating, I mean, what a difference that would make if we don't have electricity. in such a situation.
Mm. Oh, interesting. So you're running on a sort of a sustainability biosphere platform or interest.
Yeah.
Are there other things that you're quite concerned about on the island? I mean, what do you see as the challenges facing the island? Obviously, there's the biodiverse. Yeah. You know.
I did mention roading, and that ties in with cycling and bridle paths and footpaths. And there needs to be, I think, an overall strategy for that, of course. I know there's the big debate about the Esplanade.
Yes, where do you stand on the Esplanade debate? Well, bearing in mind this could affect whether people vote for you or not.
I know.
Try and hedge this one. It'll be a good challenge for you.
well, indeed. I ideally it would be great to have, say, one-way traffic down the Esplanade and, you know, a bridle path and cycleway and footpath, but, you know, that's going to cost a fortune. So the reality is, I think people needed to get involved with the questionnaire that came out. People were polled about this, and it is a crucial link in an emergency, that's true, and and it certainly needs upgrading from what it is now. And it seems to be a little racetrack for those who want to burn out on the weekends, which is not a good thing. But I'd be quite happy for it to be a pedestrian-only cycleway thing. Mm. But if it was to carry traffic as well, it would need a substantially larger sum of money, I would assume, bring it up to that.
Yes, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Personally, I feel that whole thing about it being an access way, a crucial access way, is a complete red herring, because our two main roads, which are down to Matiatia and down to Kennedy Point, are both single roads with no other access. And
well,
if they're
true.
Damaged, then you can't actually, you know, get down them, and that's just life. Whereas that particular stretch only really gives you any kind of benefit from Little O to the top of the hill in Oniroa, because
it's
otherwise...
It's the stretch, yes, between the Catholic Church and Little O, that's the vulnerable bit.
Yeah, so I can see that it's being used as an argument, but I do personally feel it's kind of lame. And I think sometimes I feel it's... If we could get that pot of money that was assigned to that, and then decide if the community board could then decide how that money was to be used, whether it was partially to be used for an upgrade of that, or partially used for something else, rather than just a sort of centralised decision to upgrade that road and then throw millions of dollars at it for something that, you know, three quarters of the community probably doesn't even really want anyway.
Well, I agree with you there. That's why I said, you know, that in an ideal world, maybe that's what would happen, but it's not going to happen. And, you know, let's build a pier as well, you know.
Yeah.
That's all sort of not going to happen. And the Onitangi Strait, I think there's quite a lot more discussion could be had about that too.
So you'd like to see it as a slower route or a faster route? Or
I don't know that. I know that people say, you know, I don't want to see it, you know, reduced down to 60 k's or stuff like that. But at the end of the day, how many seconds does that save, you know, getting to Onitangi from the shops?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who use it. But perhaps the shoulders of that road need to be looked at, you know, because people often park on the side of the road or stop because they don't know where they're going. That happens a lot on the island. And as drivers, we need to be aware that, you know, people are visiting here, and you're going to find groups of people on scooters around the corner stopped in the middle of the road, because they're not aware that we're going about our daily business from, you know, our job to home to the shops and doing those sorts of things. They just think everyone's on holiday here.
Mm. Yeah, no, fair enough. Okay, well, and the last thing is you've got your gardening column. So do you think we could get some little insider information on what we should be doing? I mean, as I was saying before, I know that this is a good time for some Maori communities feel that planting kumara is a good thing to do on around the shortest day of the year.
Garlic.
And garlic is a European one, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's your feeling about what we should be doing?
Well, getting your spring garden ready. I've got lots of salads in the garden after the drought, because my garden was just a virtual desert over the summer because I didn't have enough water. collecting seagrass, you know, and making sure it's rinsed so there's no salt left in it. For mulch, I use that. Getting the early spring crops and like beans, carrots. Carrots can grow all year. And the salads, brassicas, that's broccoli, cauliflower, cabbages.
So we can put them in as seeds, or we need to be putting them in as little plants? I noticed that slugs seem to be pretty enthusiastic at the moment.
They're enthusiastic at any time of the year. They're a bit of a pain. But I plant more than I need, and so the slugs get some, so c'est la vie. There's still enough for us to eat as well. Seeds, yeah, you can probably in containers inside get your brassicas going, and salads as well, and then plant them out. In the spring, you probably get away with sowing your lettuce seeds directly in small drills in the garden from which you can transplant them out. Carrots, of course, get sown straight into the soil. A little hint. And here's a tip, as the energy wise guy says.
Ooh,
the general rule of thumb with seeds is sow them twice the depth of the seed. That's about it. Pack them down a little bit, water them, and away you go.
Excellent. But I'm sure you're looking at ground that's been, you know, really beautifully looked after and is rich in nutrients, as opposed to my ground, which is all full of water and it's all clayish and I can't seem to do anything about it.
Yeah, organic matter, you can't go past it, can you? Horse poo, it's on the side of the road for $1 a bag.
Yeah. I've been, it's on the way to the school, there have been some horses going through, so I find I'm like scraping it off the pavement.
Put it in your compost first.
Yeah. Okay, lovely. Yeah. Okay, well, Ewan, good luck with your candidacy. And
thank
I
you
think
very much.
There's a meeting this afternoon, isn't there?
Yes, there's a seminar for those interested in standing for the community board at the service centre in Ostend at 2 o'clock. Runs till 3:45.
And you don't have to have declared already that you want to stand. You can just go and find out.
No, it's just those who have an interest. Yeah.
Yes, okay, so anyone with an interest in the standing for the community board, get down there then. It's, what time did you say?
2 o'clock.
2 o'clock.
Till 3:45.
Right, 2 o'clock at the service centre. Okay, well, lovely. Ewan, thanks very much for coming in.
You're welcome, a pleasure.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke people, events and issues, brought to you by Island, art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac, Ocean View Road, Onirua.
And we have Andrew and Millie who've come in today to talk to us about, well, I guess they're quite involved with some of the civil defence discussions that have been taking place on the island. And, so perhaps you guys would like to just comment on, you know, what are some of the challenges that face Waiheke Islanders in terms of civil defence, do you think?
Some of the challenges that people have brought up are the fact that we have tourists coming over on a daily basis, and if there was an emergency, we might find ourselves in the position of having to care for not just ourselves and our families, but a large portion of people who would not be prepared. So that's one challenge that has come up.
Oh, that's interesting. So that is quite a challenge. So what would that involve in terms of, you know, having some set up where those people could be looked after?
The classical civil defence leaflets and things, they say, well, you've got to have 3 days' supply of food and water and stuff like that, so you've got to be prepared to look after yourself because you don't know when help is going to come. But we actually, as an island, have to be a bit more prepared than that, because we may actually need to be finding people that have been stranded on the island and taking them in and or making arrangements for food and shelter. So it all leads to being a little bit more proactive and saying it's not just about taking care of ourselves and surviving, in other words, not being a victim, but being so prepared that we're actually a first responder, that we're actually able to help other people, and as a community we will survive better because we've got all these ideas already thought through. We have some idea about the issues that might come up.
Well, that's interesting. I actually have the problem going the other way, in that a couple of years ago there was a terrible storm. I think it was a couple of years ago, maybe slightly more than that, but I had a you know, something like a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old in daycare. And the winds just kind of came up all day. And of course, I was in Auckland, so I wasn't really aware of it. You know, I was in an office all day. And then I get down to the ferry, and I think coming back, that was the last ferry of the day at around 4. Had I been any later than that, I wouldn't have actually been able to get back. So I'd have a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old on the island in daycare, me stranded on the other side. Some people ended up being in hotels, some people ended up sleeping on the boat, and then there was a boat the following morning. So that I thought was quite an interesting conundrum at the time. I mean, I felt very lucky because I don't know how I would have dealt with that situation. I mean, I'm sure it's people are very generous here, so I'm sure I could have called someone and that situation would have resolved itself. But then, of course, if the phone lines are down as well and the power goes down, as I think it also went down at that time, that's also a challenge.
It's very true, and I think it's hard for people outside of the island, for people on the mainland, to realize what kinds of issues we're faced with. And so what we had a week or so ago is a meeting where the Civil Defense Organization came out and gave a standard lecture that they give all over Auckland. Their goal is merely to give this information to achieve a basic level of preparedness across the Auckland region. So they just want to get the percentage up of people who actually have a basic preparedness. And that's their mission at the moment. So what they have said to us is that we have to be responsible for the rest, and we cannot expect to be taken care of. And I think islanders understand that perhaps more than others, because we see on a daily basis how things like the ferry can stop running and all of these things can get in the way of even the most basic plans. I have a little story in that after Katrina, the organization in the U.S. that's responsible for emergency management, which is called FEMA, it was such a catastrophic failure on all levels that the organization was extremely embarrassed, and they set about tasking themselves with the question, what went wrong? Why were we not able to provide the level of support that was needed? And so they looked around for cases of places that responded to catastrophic events in a way that was successful. And what they came up with is right around that time there was an earthquake that that spawned a tsunami in the Hawaiian Islands, and there was one small island that was cut off from everyone else for over 3 days. And so they went, and when they finally got to the island, everything had been running just fine. And so FEMA went on to see what had gone on, and what they discovered is that instead of it being a hierarchy where one person was in charge of water and another person was in charge of shelter, everyone was very laterally organized and grassroots organized, so that just as you mentioned, Shirin, people who couldn't get home knew that there would be someone to take care of their children. People could cross over and do multiple jobs. So what FEMA came back with is we did not suffer from a lack of resources. We suffered from an incorrect hierarchical structure so that we couldn't respond in the way that was needed at the time.
Oh, that's really interesting. I've just been talking to I can't remember their name, but someone who deals with civil defense and the Get Through program in Wellington, and she was saying it's really important. We have this information that goes out. We have, as you say, a basic strategy, but essentially the more community involvement there can be and the more the community comes forward and says, these are some of the specific things that we feel we need, the more we can, you can start preparing for those things. And also in the bulletins that go out on the radio, you can perhaps tailor some things or some information to those needs. So she was quite interested in talking to me about what I thought the challenges were on Waiheke, and she sort of got me off guard because, to be honest, I hadn't really been thinking about that. And yes, but I remember talking a little bit about how there was an article in the paper about Rocky Bay saying something that there are areas of bush, so they see that as a potential problem. And then of course the ferry and the isolation created by being a waterlogged Ireland. Yes. So what are some of the challenges that you think we face specifically?
I think the key thing is to start getting conversations about this, because people's imagination allows them to understand what could really happen. And when we think about emergencies, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, pictures of earthquakes in Haiti and things like that. And you worry about what you're going to do if your house starts shaking, or if there's a tsunami and there's going to be a big wave. So people are very focused initially on the drama, the very first incident that might be something quite exciting, you know. But where injuries and casualties really pile up is actually in the aftermath. It's when you know, water mains are broken, and then there's no, people don't have fresh water, so you get disease coming up here. It's when there's no electricity, there's no food arriving. So it's those 2 or 3 days after any sort of event that you really need to be working with. Yes, you will. You may have an event that causes injuries. You may have fires and lightning strikes and things on the island if we got hit by a serious storm. What we're looking for in the very beginning there is just, how do we get information out, let people know what to do. Very often, you know, the default information is stay where you are. It's the best thing to do, because they don't want the roads all clogged up with people trying to get to leave Auckland, for example. Well, that's not going to happen so much on Waiheke, because we're in a very sparsely populated, less densely populated area. So most people have a reasonable amount of resources where they are already. They have their water tanks and they have their food supplies. Hopefully, you know, the advice is everybody always has enough food for 3 days. On the island, you would hope to have enough food for 5 days. What happens when the electricity goes off? I think we all rely so much, for example, on getting our information from the TV, but there's no electricity, there's no TV. Do we have battery-powered radios? Or, do we have a hand-crank radio that will work come what may? And if we do have a radio, do we know what we're going to listen to? Is it going to be tuned into Waiheke radio, or is it going to be tuned into something else? Where is the information going to come from? Will the telephones keep working? If the electricity is off, are the telephones off? Normally, if it happens locally on your house, the telephone keeps going because it's on a different system. But if the power cut affects the central station, then the telephones have gone as well.
Which is an interesting point around those telephones that have, you know, newer phones that you actually plug into the power supply, because they don't actually work. And I've had that problem in a power cut, and it's really frustrating because you're trying to work off your mobile and then the mobile network is down and you can't use the landline because you're using it through a phone that actually connects through the power, through the mains power.
So, mobile networks will always be down in an emergency situation because they're designed to prioritise the emergency services, and that would be, and the government and people like that. So they... You know, the first thing everybody does is try and phone somebody else to say, I'm in an earthquake. And yet that will often completely overload the system. Mm. And so what they can control it, they will turn it down so that those calls don't go through, unless you're actually in the number that has priority.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Well, I learned something new as well, which I hadn't realised. I only found out talking to Jane at Auckland City. I think she's responsible for the civil defence strategy. I'm not really sure what her role is. But anyway, she was saying that... I think she coordinates the civil defence strategy. I think that's what her role is. And she was saying that the second people she calls is the Auckland City switchboard. And so in an emergency, one of the things that people are encouraged to do, if they can, is to call Auckland City. And that, I thought that was quite interesting, because that would not have been my first port of call necessarily. So it's interesting that that's a possibility. I thought, you know, that was, yeah. And that they would have specific information on different, they would potentially have information on different communities. That side of the process seemed a bit more hazy, so I'm not sure. But so, I thought that was interesting that you could call Auckland City.
And I don't know if everybody's noticed, but the front, just inside the front page of all the phone books, is a list of numbers. Is that key communications list for the fire and ambulance, and also the Coast Guard and the Auckland City
Although, again, those are 111 numbers. I mean, there are some other numbers there. And Auckland City, I had a look in the phone book, is one of those numbers, certainly in the Waiheke Pony Club phone book. Yes, so I guess what you're talking about really is Auckland City has a strategic plan which encompasses the island as one of the communities that it deals with, and what you're suggesting is that we have some sort of complementary thing which develops our capabilities on the island. Is that right?
Absolutely. And this is just the beginning of the discussion, because things come up all the time, and we realize that we just mention one item, say tourism, and what is spawned from that are all of these other side issues. And to a certain extent, you can't plan for everything, but there are certainly a lot of things we could do in terms of planning different scenarios and doing some kinds of practice, running some different exercises that will prepare people. So in other areas around New Zealand, there are community resilience groups, because that's the new word, is community resilience, and that's what civil defense is asking for, is that communities become engaged. And so we are going to be starting to do that. There hasn't been a formal meeting set up at this point, but it will be in the next month, I would imagine. And so that group will start looking at the various issues and some of the initial questions, and then just taking it from there. My personal feeling is that one of the organizations that impresses me greatly is the Surf Life Saving Organization, because what they have done is they have elevated water safety to a national pastime. So they've taken something that is really just about safe water use and response and rescue, and they've turned it into a program that enriches youth and brings communities together, provides fun entertainment. And it may sound strange to think of civil defense in that way, but I have an idea that we could organize in such a way that we run through drills in ways that are creative and fun and engage the community in a positive way to be prepared without fear, because I think if we are faced with threats to our safety and we want to come together as a group, we want to have the most positive attitude towards it. So that's what my aim, my hope is for a community resilience group, is that people have a knowledge of what to do and have good communication. They know who to contact, and I'm excited about the possibility that Waiheke Radio is going to be a part of the communication network, because I think that is one of our major challenges on Waiheke, is who do we look to for information?
And I have to say, we've had a really positive response from Auckland City, and they're supporting our initiatives to try and get Waiheke Radio as part of the Memorandum of Understanding, and we would therefore be the first people to be called and could then get people into the radio station and put out broadcasts, and we'd also have stuff up on the internet. So it would be a good first port of call for people who wanted to find out more. But of course, it would rely on people having internet or radio access. And I think that's the other thing that's been part of the Get Through program, and advertising has been for people to have, as you said, battery powered or solar powered radios or crank radios. So let me ask. I mean, I listen to these get-through things, and I have to say I am not prepared. I have no idea where I can find a candle, or if I can, it'll be one of those nice-smelling ones that I have to kind of dig out from some cupboard somewhere. So, and I did have at some point I had one of those crank torches, but, blow me if I know where it is. So, are you prepared?
I'd like to say we are. It's taken a long time, though. It's taken a bit of work. And really, you never know until you've had a try. We started doing things like just pretending we had a power cut in the evening so we could find the candles. And then in the dark, and just simple things like that. And then maybe we've got some ideas that we might build up to a wake everybody up in the middle of the night, grab our emergency bag and go down to the beach or something like that to see if we actually then had everything we thought we were going to have at the time. But yes, we do have a rucksack which has got an emergency kit in it.
Sorry, hang on a second. Why are you running down to the beach?
Just to be out of the house.
To see the tsunami.
Yeah, to head for the hills or down to the beach, depending on what the issue is. But it is really just to try and have some fun. And then that's why one of the ideas would be that you could put out a game warning as opposed to an emergency warning and say, right, everybody who can, in the next half hour, has to get to this rendezvous without using their cars. And then when they get there, there's a competition to see who's brought stuff that they can actually survive with.
That's like a little orienteering challenge, isn't it?
Yeah. Instead of having to run around a piece of woodland, you know, you actually do it in the environment where it really matters, which is where you live every day. And so, you know, we can see, you know.
Maybe we could hire you guys out for children's parties, do you reckon? We're going to have a civil defense party now.
All right, kids.
Of course, I don't know. My background is from England in the 70s when we had miners' strikes and things like that in the 3-day week. And one of the really exciting things was that there was a power cut. You know, you'd have 2 or 3 nights in a week when you could have power cuts, and you suddenly discovered the joy of not having a TV on, being forced to play games with your parents, and having candles, and it was all really exciting. So it's not necessarily a bad thing as long as nobody's getting hurt.
Hmm. Yeah. No. Okay. It sounds. I really like that idea of having it set up so that people are getting prepared, but in a fun way and in a kind of a family oriented way that people can join in and take responsibility for the things that they need to know. And also, I think it might galvanize people like me who listen to these adverts and think, oh yeah, okay, but it's all a bit of effort and time and yeah.
There's a big difference between, the seminar is really good. It goes through, you know, the likely scenarios that you would encounter, and it gives you an idea of the basic items that you would need. But I have to be honest, when it first comes around, you look at the material and you do what you do with most information. You tuck the brochure away somewhere safe, and that's about it. And for us, it's been a process of over probably a year or two, and we leave it for a while, and then we go, you know what, we really don't have any plan for this. And I think it's a process. I think we are coming out of a time when we were pretty much well cared for all of the services that are available, but we're looking ahead at some things that perhaps might challenge our usual services, might overload them. And so if we're faced with that, well, we also have to realize that it's new territory for us. And the way that you learn things is not by going one day to a lecture and coming home with a set of brochures. It's actually about, on an ongoing basis, thinking about this. And so when you say, I'm not prepared, you're probably prepared to a certain extent, but you could probably be more prepared. And I would say the same for us. We are prepared to a certain extent, but there are things that we still haven't thought of. And I think it's also a part of the community getting together where you start to hear from other people and you get ideas for what someone else has done to solve a certain issue. And so learning from each other, older people on the island would certainly have a better sense of what it was before we had a 35-minute ferry. And, you know, so the landscape has changed, and we need to start training ourselves to look at things a little bit differently.
Mm. So, Millie, can you tell us there's a meeting coming up? Is that the 29th of June? Am I right in thinking that or not?
I think you could be. I was going to say the 30th, but it could be the 29th. But it is coming up, and it will be advertised in the Gulf News. They'll be putting out, Auckland City Council will be putting out an ad for it. And this will be the Auckland City Council response to a series of questions that Councillor Denise Roach had gathered from island residents about specific issues that Waiheke would face. And so these were questions that could not be answered during the seminar on basic preparedness. So this will be focused on Waiheke. So everyone is encouraged to come, because bringing all of those individual questions will help to guide the discussion and to enable Auckland City, perhaps, to start to come to grips with some of the differences on Waiheke.
Hmm. Well, it sounds really interesting, and I just hasten to add that we haven't been talking about civil defence policy here. We're not suggesting that you necessarily follow anything we've been saying. We've just been chatting about civil defence. But there are specific things that you can be doing and minimal suggestions of what you should pack or have. And I think those are labelled quite clearly in the phone book, or you can get through to www.getthrough.org.nz. And aside from that, Millie and Andrew and other people are also working on an initiative that can make us even more prepared than the minimum standards required by the Get Through, and that meet the challenges that we have on the island. So thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, we've got Fiona in from the toy library today. Well, Fiona has many hats, which one of which is community education, but today she's going to be talking about the toy library. So, Fiona, tell us about the toy library.
Good morning. So I just wanted to let everybody know a little bit about the Waiheke Toy Library, because we're in the really great position at the moment of having some spaces available in our membership. We've had a waiting list for the last few years, and it's been a little bit hard to get into the toy library, but if you are interested, then you're welcome to join at the moment. Just to give you a little bit of information, the Toy Library is a toy lending service. It's an organisation that's run by volunteers, and families can join the Toy Library for a year and then come along and borrow toys. It's a little bit like the book library in that way. So you go every fortnight, get some new toys, and then you bring them back and get some more toys. And it's just great if you've got little kids, because of course they are only interested in toys for about 2 weeks and then they forget about them. So it just means you've got a revolving array of wonderful toys all the time.
Lovely. So what kinds of toys are we talking about?
Oh, well, we've got everything. It's for kids 0 to 6 years old, so preschoolers, and we've got everything from toys for little babies, you know, things like those exosaurs that you park your little baby in and they can stand up and play with all the, you know, little jingly rattly bits around the edge. So we've got everything from baby toys through to puzzles, ride-on toys, building blocks, lots of role-play dress-up things. Oh, you name it, we've got it.
All right, sounds fabulous. And so is there a bit of a struggle when you have to give the things back? Do the kids sort of go, oh no, I really like that witch's outfit, don't give it back?
No, it's not actually. The kids get really involved with it as well, and they quite enjoy going along and choosing some new toys. It's a lot of fun for them. And the really good thing for families is it just keeps all the costs down, because you pay a membership fee for the year, which is $46 for the whole year. And after that, you don't have to pay anything. Some of the toys, some of the more expensive toys, you can pay a $2 hireage fee, but that's the most you're ever going to pay to get a toy out. So the kids love it, because they have the access to toys that, you know, as a family, you probably couldn't afford to buy them if you just walked into the toy shop.
Mm. Not to mention, it can be difficult looking after lots of toys and dealing with all the clutter and keeping it all organised. And
absolutely. Well, this week, my kids, who are 3 and 5, had out a baby doll set with a whole lot of clothes. They had a My Little Pony set. You can tell this is the little girl who was choosing last week. And a really cool medieval knight's castle, which is a massive big wooden castle that sort of takes up half the lounge floor with all the little dragons and knights. And they've just had a wonderful time. They've combined all three things into one game. So the dragons eating the My Little Pony and, you know, all that kind of thing. It's lots of fun.
So is it hard keeping track of all this stuff? Because I find sometimes I have trouble keeping track of the library books. And, you know, I'm like, oh my my God, they're due, and then I run around and look for the library book that's fallen down behind the bed.
Oh, it sounds like our household. We're exactly like that as well. But actually, all of the toys come in bags or boxes, and they have a list of everything that you're supposed to take back to the library. So it's all very clearly itemised. It's quite easy to count up. And you can normally keep them in the box while you've got them at home so that you don't tend to lose them. And, you know, if something does go missing, you go into the library, you tell them that a piece has gone missing, but then you get a few months to actually bring it back. Normally the pieces turn up the next time.
Oh, so, really? Oh,
okay. And one of the really nice things about the organisation, because it is run by the members, what happens is that you join the library and then you also volunteer to help a couple of mornings a year. So it's not a huge commitment, but it's really great because it means that everybody feels like it's their library and they're involved. They help look after the toys and it works really well.
Oh, it sounds fabulous. So how many families take part in that?
Well, for the... We've just expanded our membership. So a few years ago, we only had 50 members, 50 member families involved, but now we have space for 100 families, which is great because it's more people to share the load of helping, but it also means that we have more toys and more resources for everyone. So it's good, but we do have a few spaces at the moment. So if you want to join, come down and have a look if you like.
I think I want to have more children so I can... You know, sign up for the toy library. That sounds a bit tragic, doesn't it?
Oh, I know. Well, the mums and dads do end up playing with the toys as well, of course. Mm. But if people are interested in finding out a bit more, they're welcome to come down and have a look at the library. We are open every fortnight. This is one of the weekends that we have openings. So you could pop down today. We're open this afternoon from 1 o'clock till 3 o'clock. And then again on Sunday morning, we'll be open from 9:30 till 11:30. So if you're interested, come in and have a look. Introduce yourself to the toy library, Shaquilla, and she'll show you around and let you know a bit more about it.
And where is it exactly? Surfdale Post Office?
Oh, good question. Yes, it is. It's the old Surfdale Post Office, which is just beside Surfdale Hall. The other thing that you can do if you're interested is have a look at our website, which is www.waihekitoylibrary.co.nz. And if you're interested in joining, you can call our membership officer, Sue, and her number is 372-2408.
Right. But it's probably a good idea to just go down and have a look to see if that's what you're really interested in.
Absolutely. And just have a look at the toys. Have a look at what's on offer. Find out how it works and if it's the right thing for you.
Lovely.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirola.